From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in April when the Federal Communications Commission announced plans to roll back net neutrality regulations. And so what exactly is net neutrality? If it sounds a little boring, well, it's important. It's about the future of internet freedom and regulation. And since that April announcement, more than 8 million comments have been submitted to the agency. Yes, I'm sure some by bots, but also by a lot of citizens who are worried about this. And we suspect you have questions about how this could affect you. I certainly do. We're going to try to answer them this hour with our guests in studio. Josephine Wolfe is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Computing Security at RIT. Josephine, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also here is Jeremy Sarakin, Chair of the Media and Communication Department at St. John Fisher College. Long time no see.
Thanks. I'd love to be back.
That's great to have you back here. There's a lot to work through, and listeners, I think I'm with you if you're feeling like this is it gets a little dense or you're not exactly sure how this could impact us. And if you've got questions on net neutrality, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Josephine, I would ask you, what's at stake? But then, you know, the next half hour we'd probably just be hearing from you. But I kind of do want to start broadly with what's at stake, and then we kind of work through some of the specifics. So right now, what's at stake here?
Right now, what we're looking at is the FCC in the middle of the process to try and repeal rules that went into effect under the last administration's FCC, which essentially said that internet service providers, these companies like Spectrum, Verizon, that provide service to end users, that provide that connectivity to your home, aren't allowed to discriminate. The packets that they're sending to your home aren't allowed to say, we're going to send the Netflix packets very quickly or very slowly, depending on whether or not Netflix has paid us, aren't allowed to say, we're not going to send the Netflix packets at all because we have a competing service like Hulu that we're really invested in or because they've paid us. So there's the no discrimination rule. That's part of the open internet order that we're looking at appealing. There's also a no blocking rule, which says, you know, beyond just no discrimination, you can't just decide here are all of these services either because they compete with us or because they haven't given us enough money. We're just going to block them and users aren't going to be able to have access to them. And then there's also a whole set of investigatory and transparency rules built into that open internet order that say the FCC can investigate what internet service providers are doing in terms of potentially anti-competitive practices. And those we're also looking at repealing as part of this.
What is the doomsday? Those really concerned about this think the worst case scenario is what?
Well, it really depends which side you're on. If you're on the pro-net neutrality, net neutrality is really important side, then the doomsday is internet service packages that look a lot like your cable television packages that say, you know, for $80 a month, you can have the bare bones approved internet service to these websites that have paid Spectrum some amount of money. If you pay us an extra $20 a month, you can add on these other websites. If you pay us an extra $50 a month, you can have internet premium access to any website that you want. That's the doomsday scenario if you're concerned about net neutrality going into effect. On the other side, if you think that it's potentially a bad thing, your doomsday scenario is all of these big internet service providers have all of these restrictions placed on them, can't get as much money from different websites or from different customers, and therefore stop investing in internet infrastructure. And we see a huge decrease in the amount of cable being laid, in the amount of investment going into beefing up infrastructure across the country.
All right, Jeremy, how do you view the broad outlines of this debate right now?
I think it's funny because it's sort of going along the same lines as politics are right now, which hasn't always been true. There's this question of whether government should have sort of a hand in things or whether it should be more left to the free market. And that seems to be kind of where it's dividing. What's funny about the internet is it's really sort of philosophically where you think about of what the internet is. If it's a public utility, the way roads are, and it's having a service to people, then it's something that should be regulated so that it remains equal for everyone. If that's not your major concern, then you look to see ways where it can be more profitable.
On that subject of the utility, Ajit Pai is the chairman of the FCC, and he talked to NPR about this, and he answered that question, whether internet service should be treated as an essential utility. I want to read his answer and get both of our guests' response on that. He says, I think it would separate into two different pieces. The first piece is that the internet is increasingly essential to Americans in their daily lives. When you go to work, you use the internet. When you want to educate your kids at home, you use the internet. Even things like precision agriculture require internet connectivity. So to achieve that goal of providing internet access, we need to make sure that we have rules that promote much more infrastructure investment than we currently have. The second piece, however, is a much more arcane legal question, which is, what is the right legal framework to secure those protections of a free and open internet? Is it the Title II utility-style regulation inspired by the 1930s? Is it the Clinton-era approach, which is light-touch regulation? Should Congress step in 2017 and give us more modernized rules for the digital road, so to speak? That is the debate that we're having here in Washington today. Is he dodging anywhere there? Does that sound like he's putting it sort of correctly there, Jeremy?
I think he's dodging to some extent, because if it was sort of truly a public utility and that was sort of even part of the conversation, it would be free and you wouldn't have, basically it would be government run and you wouldn't have companies and corporations running it at all. And that's not really even sort of in what he's saying. So instead, he's trying to jump around sort of like small ideas, like how can we change it? What can we do to sort of make it simpler? And he's sort of trying to put in arguments that I'm not sure if they hold water. I mean, there is the argument that this will allow corporations or companies and ISPs to invest more in the infrastructure. But this seems like such a lucrative business to be in anyhow that it seems like they would be foolish not to do that. And so sort of putting that as a reason seems a bit of rhetorical strategy to me.
So he's saying a lot of the things that people might broadly agree with for those who believe it should be viewed as a utility, but then the actual steps toward that are sort of weak toast here, right?
Right.
It's like saying every house in this town should be given an almond croissant every morning because almond croissants are great. And, you know, they make everyone happy. And we all need almond croissants every morning because they are scientifically way better than chocolate croissants. And what are we going to do? Well, we're going to offer 5 almond croissants every morning until they're gone. Wait a second. You have a bakery. You could bake almond croissants for everybody. He said, well, no. Then we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So you agree on the premise that we all need almond croissants. We all need internet. But we're not kind of really going to do that.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's what it is. And so the arguments that come out, I mean, I think that I hear are very much sort of on the side of sort of the corporate side of things that want it a certain way.
Okay. Are you pro almond croissant or chocolate croissant, by the way?
Chocolate croissant.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, everybody has a right to be wrong. Josephine, how do you feel about Pai's comments there regarding the internet as utility?
I think what he's saying is, yes, he thinks the internet is a utility. Yes, he thinks that people need it in their everyday lives to apply for jobs, apply to school, everything else, but that he's not convinced that it should be regulated the way that we've historically regulated other types of utilities in this country. And that's why he's talking about the Title II provisions that do come out of the Communications Act of the 1930s, updated in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. That's why he's saying, you know, yes, I'm open to the idea this is a utility, this is something people need, but just because we've made that concession, and again, I think he's making that concession, though it's a little bit ambiguous in that answer, doesn't mean that I want to turn to all of these historical precedents that we've used to regulate the telephone companies to sort of put in place what utility regulation looks like historically.
Okay, and before I jump to your phone calls, Bruce and Aranda-Coit, hang there. We've got some questions that have already come in via email. Jeremy, let me just follow up on a point you were making. This wasn't always kind of partisan, but it's pretty partisan right now, at least it looks that way in Congress.
I think it's more so. We were actually discussing this before it started, but I'm actually going to turn it over to my...
Oh, well, yes, I would say it's definitely gotten more partisan in the past year, but in the past several years as well. And I think a couple things happened. One was just that the Open Internet Order went into effect under the Obama administration and therefore became sort of hitched to the idea of being a Democratic or Democrats' agenda. And the second is just that right now, at least, the idea of Republican regulation seems very closely tied to deregulation. So repealing rules in general seems like a very Republican thing. I think prior to this, when you're looking at, say, the George W. Bush administration, there's no clear sense that net neutrality is something that divides along party lines.
Does everything divide along party lines now? Is that just sort of what it is?
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah. And one of the things also that people have sort of done is kind of look at donors to members of Congress and trying to connect the dots on, oh, well, who's contributing to your campaigns or who's giving you money and where do you stand on the issue? Do you see, should we be concerned about any connection there?
Certainly, there are a lot of very rich companies with a lot of interest in this. Most of them are giving money to everybody, so I don't know how easy it is to connect the dots there, but definitely there are very powerful lobbying interests around this issue.
Okay. Let me grab our first phone call because, again, one of the things we want to do this hour is try to answer your questions about the practicality of this. How could this impact all of us? And I'm going to start with Bruce and Aranequib with that. Go ahead, Bruce.
Up until recently, this has already been in practice. Time Warner, who has TV and cable, would not allow me to go through to ESPN3 unless I had cable services through them. I have cable. I have ESPN membership through my DirecTV, but because my IP came from a Time Warner IP pool, I wasn't allowed through. So if anybody out there is thinking that, oh, they wouldn't do that kind of thing, they have already done that kind of thing. And we need to make sure that when you buy the service, that you get it open. It's like saying you can only call certain people. If they're on our same telephone, you can only call them. You can only call Verizon people. You can only call Sprint people. You can only call AT&T people. It needs to be open. It needs to be, you know, there's competition. And those companies see, you know, there's expansion already now with it. I mean, Greenlight coming into the area, and Greenlight's a great product, anybody out there listening. There's expansion. There's growth. There's nothing right now that is stopping that. So their argument that it'll stop investment is spacious.
Bruce, thank you. I reached out to Greenlight. They didn't get back to me over the last couple of days, probably because they're really busy. They've got a lot going on, so I don't blame Greenlight, but we were interested in seeing if they wanted to comment here. Let me ask our guest to respond to some of what you heard from Bruce. Josephine?
Well, I think that there are a couple things that should be clarified about the current open internet order, which we're probably in the process of repealing. First of all, there are a lot of exceptions to it. So when you're talking about what Time Warner, now Spectrum, will or won't let you go to in terms of television subscriptions, there is a big carve-out for what are called specialized services in the open internet order. Nobody exactly knows what they mean. We haven't had a lot of time to sort that out. We probably won't have time now to figure out what that looks like. But there are still a lot of caveats to thinking through sort of when internet service providers do have some leeway to decide what they do or don't want to give their customers.
Okay, Jeremy?
Yeah. I think the question of competition is interesting because, I mean, an argument for this is that even if we don't have net neutrality, that there'll be enough competition to kind of make things the way that the public wants. And I don't think we've sort of seen evidence of that. We have... I'm thinking like there's DirecTV in town, Frontier, Spectrum, and Greenlight. Not DirecTV, but the later three. But still, you know, they have different problems. Greenlight still isn't in every community, just waiting. And so I think it won't be enough. I think it's too expensive to set up internet connections, and there won't be enough for the free market to sort of take care of it.
And I would say... just quickly, that's very rare to have those options. More than half of the country's population only has one option for internet service.
Sure. And so that's one of the concerns, I think, that those who are worried about this rollback of net neutrality have. And at the risk of piggybacking on what seems like a daily conversation in the Wonka sphere about neoliberalism, this is sort of in that line of conversation about do we commoditize everything or do we recognize certain things as an important public good now? And what do we do about that to make sure there isn't discrimination? I want to listen to some of what Ajit Pai said on NPR. He was asked, you know, do you think broadband providers are really capable of not discriminating against someone like a Netflix or even a not yet developed Netflix clone, that kind of a thing? And here's what Pai said about broadband companies.
This is precisely why some people say Title II is necessary. Some people say no regulation is necessary. I've consistently said that, look, the Clinton-era light-touch approach is the right one. Let the marketplace develop, and if we see an example of any competitive conduct, then you can take targeted action to address that problem. But that's part of the approach that we hope to embrace on a bipartisan basis going forward, just as it was embraced in 1996 by President Clinton in a Republican Congress.
All right, so there's Pai talking about exactly what Jeremy and Josephine just mentioned, which is you know, they have skepticism that the market can work in a way that is that efficient for consumers. And Pai is saying he thinks it can. And when it doesn't, after the fact, you go in and then you regulate, as opposed to trying to get out front of it and assume that things won't be good for consumers. Josephine, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the internet today is very different than it was in the 1990s when
it's a strange comparison. And let me back up and say, I don't know anybody who we had a conversation with Josephine, I think last year, and she's written for Slate and has written about how hard it is to regulate the internet because of the constant change. So to sit here 21 years later and say, well, it kind of worked then, is strange to me.
Yeah, I think that's a very dangerous way of thinking, because if you're always sitting here saying, you know, we're going to wait until the internet matures and then we're going to regulate, then nobody knows what that means when the internet matures. There's always been this cycle where we see new technologies, and once upon a time it was the telephone come out, and when they're brand new and nobody has them, of course you don't say, well, this is a fundamental right, everybody needs this. You say only the very rich or the very interested or the very avant-garde are going to experiment with this. And you also say, look, there's a huge investment that needs to be made in infrastructure because we haven't set up this infrastructure yet. In the 90s, that was true of the internet, right? There was really a big need if we were going to build this out to scale. And now we're looking at a picture that's very different for several reasons. One is which is there's a lot more infrastructure than there was then already in place. Another is that the internet is much more essential to every life, which Ajit Pai himself acknowledges in the earlier quote that you read. So it's no longer as much a question of just saying we're going to sort of sit back and see how this develops and maybe people will need it and maybe they won't, the way it might have been under President Clinton. And so I think it's a mistake to be thinking that we should be treating the internet the same way that we did in the mid-90s.
Okay, Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think about how the internet has changed content-wise. Back in the 90s, I mean, everything was text-based with some images. You know, it's fun to look at the Wayback Machine website where you can see what a website used to be. And, you know, look at McDonald's and it looks like a 10-year-old did it. you know, I mean, it wasn't really competing with anything else.
Sure.
Now you have the internet as being the source for most of our media. Newspapers, which is video-based. Television. Or television shows. Now there's this talk that, of course, within a few years, more and more schedule-based broadcast television is going to become less and less important. And so if you're getting your shows through the internet, because instead of on cable, you're subscribing to Netflix and Hulu and HBO Go or whatever, then the speed in which you get things and how you get things matters a lot. It's actually how we get information as opposed to, in the 90s, you know, a small alternative way.
And we are, by the way, again, to talk a little bit about some of the exceptions in the open internet order, which I think are very much sort of underappreciated, we do carve out for wireless internet. We say, look, this doesn't apply to them because that's a new emerging technology that hasn't been around long enough. We don't have enough infrastructure. So we are treating some things the way that, say, Clinton was treating broadband in the 90s, but we're not treating everything that way.
All right, before I get to Warren on the next line, let me go ahead and listen to one more comment here for our guests to respond to. It comes from Alexis Ohanian, who is the co-founder and executive chairman of Reddit. And here is what Ohanian had to say about net neutrality.
Reddit 12 years ago was two recent college grads in an apartment. Steve and I had nothing going for us other than a great idea and some laptops. And we were able to build something that today is one of the 10 most trafficked sites in the United States. We want to keep that opportunity available for the next generation of entrepreneurs. And we don't want our internet to start looking like our television cable. We don't want to have tiered access. We don't want to have all the things that have really stifled innovation in other industries. We want tech to continue to flourish, even if that means promoting things that you know, are really in the best interests of the internet and maybe not ourselves.
And he went on to say that Ajit Pai has a background working with the companies interested in breaking the internet. So interesting comments from Ohanian. And Josephine, is he on to something that entrepreneurs may be more limited in their own access in the future if it continues to go this way and net neutrality is rolled back?
That's fair. I think one of the things that you see a lot of people concerned about, not the big name companies that have already established themselves necessarily, but the people who are sort of more in the advocacy space talking about, is if it becomes the norm for service providers to charge websites for providing their content at all, for providing their content at a certain speed or quality of service, then if you're starting a new website, whether it's the new Reddit or whatever, that's going to be much harder for you to afford. That's going to be a huge barrier to entry in that space, in a field that typically we've thought of as very easy to enter, that, you know, two college students can set up and make big on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go off on that. And that, I mean, I teach web design classes, and people often don't realize how easy it is even today. So, you know, if you basically, you know, if you are at a college, you get server space for free. If you're not, it's incredibly cheap. I say $100 a year, and it's probably a lot cheaper if you find the right source. So you can make a website. I mean, it's obviously the expense of having people who can do it correctly and design it correctly and sort of know the programming side of it. But just sort of having it out there is so affordable. And if this sort of breaks that, then we basically become stuck with the companies we have. And no one can go forward. And it's not just new companies. It's people simply wanting to get out new content. Someone wants to do a site about a public issue that they promote, that they're not making any money on. Things like that could have be harder to get to without net neutrality.
All right, lots of people waiting to talk about this issue. Warren in Rochester next. Go ahead, Warren.
Hi, yes. With the talk of ISPs expanding like Google Fiber, has recently had to either scale back or almost completely give up because of all the like legal issues they were having going through some of the cities. Like, they would get held back by some of the major internet providers that were like already in that town, and they would just keep getting delayed, and they had to keep spending millions of dollars to try and expand the infrastructure where they kept, I don't know if that's anything to do with Title II or whatnot, but there are places trying, but it seems like some of the big players are pushing them back. Hmm. They're the ones that are behind the push, seems like.
All right. Thoughts on that from our guests?
Well, definitely industries that we've thought of in the communication space have historically been very monopolistic, going back to AT&T and the one Bell service for the whole country. And Title II is exactly, as you say, set up to deal with that monopoly issue. Title II is designed to say, what do you do if you've got a big monopoly? How do you make sure it doesn't take advantage of that power? And one of the fights that you see around net neutrality, around regulation of internet service providers in general, is this issue of, is this a monopoly? For a lot of people, it is. In a lot of parts of the country, they only have one choice. And if so, then does it make sense? And certainly the previous FCC thought it did, to regulate them under those Title II provisions that were set up for exactly the problem you described, to deal with the fact that it is not easy to enter the space and be competitive when you're building out infrastructure.
And go read, before I turn to Jeremy, go read what Chuck Schumer wrote in the New York Times about how the Democrats view their path forward after recent electoral losses. Schumer wrote a lot about antitrust, about monopoly, and this is language that I'm sure populists and Bernie Sanders supporters are much more familiar with, but not necessarily centrist Democrats or even, you know, Democrats who've been in power since the Clinton administration. But they are looking at mergers. They're looking at this saying, you know, for all the talk that this is good for the consumer, it's good for prices, that doesn't really wash, and it becomes anti-competitive. It's very hard to enter the marketplace, and it's not even necessarily that good for consumers. And Senator Schumer's comments on this, not even necessarily just about net neutrality, but about monopolistic behavior and how government has allowed for concentration of corporate power, I thought they were interesting this week. They did represent a shift. Jeremy, some thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with all of this. The idea of net neutrality and controlling monopolies is going to help prevent or allow more competition. And so if there's an issue with Google not getting in, then leaving it to the free market's just going to make it worse.
All right. Before I come back to your phone calls, one more quick question from Twitter. In our second half hour, if you're on the line, Rich, Mike in Brighton, we've got more phones ringing. We're going to take more of your questions coming up. Paul wants to know on Twitter, what about if the city of Rochester provides free internet? Are they the ISP? Do public ISPs affect this debate?
If it depends on how the city of Rochester hypothetically provided free internet and what that would mean, right? If what we mean is they're going to pay the spectrum bill for every person in the city, which is not something I've heard of any city ever doing, then no, they're not the service provider. They're footing the bill. They're underwriting it. If you mean they're actually going to lay fiber to every single home in the city and build the infrastructure themselves and operate it, then yes, potentially they could be a service provider.
Okay. Well, let's get our only break of the hour. And let's come back to your phone calls. Rich, Mike, Bruce, let's come back to your questions. If you've got comments, you can call the program or you can email me, edawson@wxxi.org. You can find me on Twitter, @EvanDawson. We are talking about the future of net neutrality with our guest for the hour, Josephine Wolfe, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Computing Security at RIT, Jeremy Sarakin, Chair of the Media and Communications Department at St. John Fisher College. Your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the Summer of Food on Connections. Second hour every Thursday this summer, dedicated to having conversations about the local food and ag scene, dining, restaurants, trends, and more. We're looking at the Finger Lakes Culinary Bounty and trying to answer this question. If the great food writer James Beard were alive today, redoing his book on American cookery, what would the Finger Lakes food, culture, and identity be? That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go to Rich in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, there's two things I want to comment. First, I want to make a comment on the looking at 1996 internet. That's like someone saying to me, you know, back in 1901, we didn't need red lights. Why do we need them now in 2015? It's a ridiculous statement to even make from a man who professes to be this technological leader. So that's one thing that's troubling. Also, on the cost of these services, me being in the networking profession, these services, as far as transport of data over the wires and over the fiber, is constantly dropping. The pricing, I mean, you like example, you would replace a router for $1,500, right? And the original one that you're replacing that you bought for $1,500, you're getting like a 4x. Increase in efficiencies and everything. And so these ISPs are constantly talking about the prices being driven up. But the reality is, I don't think, from my perspective, the infrastructure, the cost of the infrastructure itself is going up, especially if you start looking at the traffic that is going over these infrastructures and the physical cost it is to build them. So ISPs crying about how much this is costing them, I just doubt it. And also they're also consolidating their customer services, so they're saving this money everywhere. So I just don't see, from my perspective, this supposed strain on these ISPs. Maybe someone else could shed a light that I'm not seeing.
Okay, Rich, thanks for the phone call, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pricing is based on supply and demand. I think it's a question of how much can they get people to pay. There's, as we've been talking about, very little competition, and that's what bases it. That's what it's based on, not on how much it necessarily costs them, which is the way a lot of businesses are, certainly. I mean, you can even see that in the sense of, and this would be true whether or not there was net neutrality, but the fact that you can have different ranges where if you have a business plan, you're going to get of faster internet because you're paying more. Clearly, the infrastructure is there to provide it to you. It's simply they can get you to pay for what you're willing to pay for.
Okay. Josephine?
Well, I would say, I guess, a little bit in the defense of the ISPs, that the model for communications technology providers for more than a century has been that they work in an industry with really high sunk costs up front and fairly low marginal costs. So the deal that we've been cutting with them, again, for more than 100 years, is if you spend this enormous amount of money up front to dig up the streets and lay wire and build out this infrastructure, then we're going to pay that back to you over the course of the next several years, not because the service you're providing to us over those years is going to cost that much, but because you put up these huge upfront costs. And that's also a big part of the reason that these have tended towards monopolistic.
Let me also, just before I jump back to the phones, fill in. Paul on Twitter had asked earlier about, well, what happens if the city of Rochester kind of gets into this business? Does it become the ISP, et cetera? And I know that in the mayor's race, this has come up. One of the candidates has made some proposals. Current Mayor Lovely Warren has said that she thinks this is an example of where one of her opponents, Rachel Barnhart, is just sort of naive about the cost or is being unrealistic about the cost. Rachel Barnhart, a Democrat in the race, says she wants to wire every home with fiber. Early estimates, that's $70 million, which would be shared by the city school district, Rochester, and the vendor. And, you know, again, you have to figure out who that's going to be. And she said operating costs would be covered by people paying for one gigabit service. And for everyone else, the service is free at speeds they currently get from Spectrum and Frontier. But she has said this needs more study. And the mayor has said, and I'm trying to sum up based on, I've seen some forums where this has come up, so certainly if I'm wrong, I'd be happy to correct it. But the mayor essentially said, you know, it's valuable to work with people to make sure that everyone has access to jobs and to opportunity. But what Rachel Barnhart is proposing is a lot of money that currently just isn't sort of sitting there. And Barnhart essentially said, well, we have to try. So, but if I'm mischaracterizing, I'll be certainly happy to correct it. That's coming from memory, and I'm just based on Paul on Twitter. So, yeah, the mayoral candidates have brought it up, and I guess the question is feasibility. And it's a lot of infrastructure. It'd be a lot of work, right, Josephine?
It's a lot of money. Look, I mean, there are three times in history that this country has laid a wire to every single home in it. There's electricity, there's telephone, and there's cable. It doesn't happen a lot. It's expensive.
Okay, so that's we'll see what comes out of that part of the conversation going forward. Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Brighton next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say early in the show, the worst case scenario for those in favor of net neutrality would be a sort of a system where people might have to pay more for premium content and things like that. I'm a person who's, you know, sometimes ashamed to admit that I have the big cable package, and I would probably suck it up and pay for the big internet package as well. But what I see as an even worse scenario is one in which maybe the content is tied to the sort of corporate ethos rather than just a financial reason. To be particularly acute in a place that only has one ISP, say they only allow access to Fox but not NPR. Or for other people, you know, the other way around, maybe torture as well. And I just wondered if that's a separate sort of level of debate, or if that is something that would indeed be possible if these rules are repealed.
Mike, thank you. Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like all of this is possible, and that's the problem. If you think about sort of older media, there's always ways, at least for, say, print media, there's always ways to get it out. You can print a newspaper, and you can, you know, get it distributed and published. Like, no one's going to stop you, in a sense, if you have the money to sort of pay for the printing and so forth. This is a case where it's really giving so much power, so much of the gatekeeping to ISPs, that it's not just one who's willing to sort of pay more for certain things. It's whether things will be available at all. And so you can control the conversation. You can control political conversation, all those things, again, in a worst-case scenario. So those are all sort of worrisome issues. And the other thing to talk about is, unlike the caller just now, not everyone could afford it. So maybe even if it was like, you can have everything if you're willing to pay for it, a lot of people wouldn't. A lot of people can't afford it. And so, again, you're controlling the access to information according to class lines, which is problematic.
What Jeremy just said could probably also be applied to the healthcare conversation.
Right.
You can get everything. You can have the best healthcare if you have the money for it. And should it be that way? That's one of the big debates about healthcare. Well, here is an email from a listener named Teal. She says, Internet service stopped being a luxury and became a need when employers stopped accepting walk-in applicants and when hospitals and medical systems started using electronic records to the exclusion of everything else. How do the poor and unemployed apply for jobs if a company only takes online applications? Elderly and low-income individuals who don't have access to the Internet can't get appointment changes or test results because doctors' offices do not make phone calls anymore. My care, anyone? Everyone should have equal access because even basic employment and health care are making the public dependent on it. What do you think, Josephine?
So I think one of the big unresolved issues, if we repeal these open internet orders, is this question of what is the baseline that we think everybody deserves when it comes to internet access, which is not something that we've seen the internet service providers grapple with in a serious way, right? You brought up healthcare. So if we accept that people can pay for better healthcare, which by and large we do in this country, then one of the things we see Congress fighting over right now is sort of what's the lowest level of healthcare that we think people should be guaranteed. If we're going to accept that people can pay for different levels of internet access, then the question becomes, well, what do we need to be guaranteeing to people who aren't going to be able to afford extras? And that's just not a conversation that the FCC seems very interested in having right now.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy?
I mean, I think the technological access question is interesting as well. One of the reasons why computers were put in libraries was because it was going to give people more access. But now with cheaper computers, more people, you know, feel that they're correct, that there's such a need for smartphones that they, again, not all people of all classes, but if they can, they figure out a way to get it, and you can access the web through that. So in a way, the technological barriers are lower. So that's why the sort of net neutrality issue is sort of so important, because, okay, we got rid of, to some extent, one barrier, but now we're maybe going to create another one.
All right, next on the line, let's go to Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay, Evan, you know how totally ignorant I am of the internet and technology. So I want someone to answer the question for me. Wasn't the internet, when the infrastructure was put in, wasn't it heavily subsidized by the taxpayer? And I'm going to hang on the line because I've got something else more.
Okay.
But wasn't it heavily subsidized, the infrastructure, by the taxpayer? Somebody said, oh, it cost them so much to dig up this and put in the infrastructure, so that justifies a certain amount of privilege in terms of determining prices and so forth. So is that true, Evan? Just answer me.
Well, Jane, I may be just as ignorant as you on this. Well, okay. That's how we've got guests here. Josephine?
Okay.
Well, it's actually a very complicated question, because the internet infrastructure...
Wait a minute, please, because I'm going to get off the line in just a minute if we start going into it's so complicated. But everything that I have heard and understood was that it was sold as such a necessity for all of us. It would bring all of us, all of this information highway and everything. So it was subsidized. We all, in other words, what I'm saying is, participated in bringing about the internet. And what I'm getting at is, I think that there should be equal access, that it should not be based on supply and demand, as long as it's partially a socialistic entity anyway. So this supply and demand, I am for people having equal access and not getting to the point where the poor may not be able to afford the highest quality of access. So that's where I'm going, and I'd really rather not hear about complications. I want to ask one further thing, Evan. Is one of your guests a consumer advocate?
Jane, thank you. They can give their background. Go, Josephine, again, tell Jane who you are.
I'm an academic. I study technology policy.
Okay, and Jeremy?
Yeah, I'm also an academic. I study more sort of the social, psychological side of technology.
We invited members of Congress, someone from Greenlight, people in consumer advocacy. Jeremy and Josephine were the only ones available, and that's the only reason they got asked. I'm kidding. we reached out to them because they have been wonderful guests before, but they both happen to be academics, Jane. And Josephine, Jane may not like to hear it, but what you were saying is, you know, the question on whether it was sort of heavily subsidized, you think is complicated.
I'll be very brief and as uncomplicated as I can. The initial funding for the protocols that later became the Internet Protocol did come from the federal government, was taxpayer funded. On the other hand, the initial infrastructure that people first accessed the internet through was the telephone lines, which were partly funded by governments, but also in large part funded by private industry. And we've seen the infrastructure change over the past several years, which is one of the reasons I say it's a complicated question, right? It's no longer, for most people, something that they get over their telephone lines. It's often something they get over their coaxial cable connection, which is also, for the most part, private industry funded. But there is a lot of government involvement in all of these things, because infrastructure always involves government. Anytime you're going to dig up a street, anytime you're going to lay a wire down a public street, you have government permits, licenses, involvement in this. And so you're absolutely right that there's a certain amount of taxpayer funding that goes into building the internet and making it what it is, but there's also a large private industry investment.
Okay. And Jeremy, go ahead.
Yeah. I think two things that are sort of interesting to keep in mind. I always find students aren't completely aware of this because they've been born so recently, 18, 19 years ago, is that the internet's, you know, dates back to the 60s. The web is only since 1990. And so our conception of it sort of being out there is very different for different people.
People usually define the internet and the web as like the same thing here, though, Jeremy.
They
so
do.
You've blown our mind here.
They do. And so the web is like sort of the interface that people see that used to be all text in the mostly text, and then went into the video. That's the web. Internet includes things like email, file transfer protocols, all the other ways that you can send messages online that aren't necessarily the sort of interface, whether it's visual or whatever.
Okay. Jane, thank you. Let's go to Keith in Greece next. Go ahead.
Evan, it's Keith.
Hi, Keith.
Quick question. Does the amount of channels, television channels, that you have available to you affect the speed? For example, let's say if I have basic cable and I'm only can access 12 channels versus somebody who has 150 channels available to them? Would that affect the speed at all? And the reason why I'm asking this is I personally think it's about time we're allowed to go a la carte. In other words, if I want, sports, I can get all 1,200 ESPNs, whatever they have. If I want news, I can buy certain news channels. What I don't like about the bundling, and I'm not sure if it does slow down the speed that you receive it, is the channels that I have never, ever spent a moment watching, the God channels, the shopping channels, but basically ESPN, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So the bigger bundles use more that you don't really need. That's the question.
I'll answer this as a consumer more than anything else, but it just seems to me that if you're watching stations and if other people in your house are watching more stations, the signal doesn't break up. So, I mean, that's sort of simple, but I actually think that it doesn't matter. I think, at least certainly in terms of cable, I don't think it matters in terms of what your bundle is.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to the phones then, and we'll go to John and Irondequoit next. Go ahead, John.
Hi. One of the things that I kind of take issue with, if you're going to wire a city or a municipality, I don't think you'd actually use wire. I think you do it all wirelessly now. So you'd only have to pay for wireless stations, which would be incredibly cheaper than having to go to everybody's individual house.
I think that's actually a very common misunderstanding about internet infrastructure right now, which is we have seen a huge growth in the wireless area, and I hope we will continue to see more growth there. But most of the traffic we are running, even the wireless traffic, most of it is, say, going through your home router over your wired broadband connection. There is just a huge disparity in performance between what we can send over wireless, how far we can send it, how fast it can go, the quality of that service. So most of what we rely on, most of what we're going to continue to rely on for high traffic activity over the foreseeable future is still going to have to come from wired broadband.
And again, that's not just now and the next year or two or three. You think that's the foreseeable future.
And what people keep saying in this industry is that we're going to see higher and higher bandwidth applications, that we're going to be looking at virtual reality, that we're going to be looking at all these things that require even larger volumes of traffic, which again is going to increase our dependence on those wired connections.
Okay.
I've definitely myself seen evidence of that. Even at my college, we recently set up a new lab, and there's this idea, can it be a wireless lab, even within the small space of the college? And when we said, well, no, it has video, you have to be able to upload and download video. It's for video editing. It was like, oh, that's impossible. So we aren't there yet.
James in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, James.
Yes, thank you. I believe that, you know, I hear a lot of talk about infrastructure and bandwidth and applications therein, consumerism. And I happen to stumble upon a Department of Defense memo, maybe published 6 or 5 years ago, in regards to the electromagnetic spectrum and our nation's adaptability with proliferating technologies. And so within that document that I was reading, there's pretty much the government saying how they would like to see more of a proliferation of said technologies so that it would enable them to have more of a corner on it in terms of national security. So with all this being said, it will be interesting to see how net neutrality shakes out in terms of that, because on one side, people are speaking of building up the infrastructure to be able to fulfill those capacities, you know, with VR and, you know, the forecasting larger usage of the electromagnetic spectrum, and where the net neutrality thing falls into that with consumerism, you know, because it's going to be a double-edged sword. You don't want to push the consumers out because they won't necessarily want to be there.
Okay. James, thank you. Anything to add to that, Jeremy?
I think one thing to consider is that in terms of sort of privacy issues, which the caller mentioned, aren't necessarily affected directly to consumers by net neutrality, in that what you do online is still going to be available, even if you're limited in the sites you can go to. So I think that's, I think sometimes that's kind of put into this being like government regulation will lead to less privacy. And I'm not sure they're as interconnected as sometimes we're led to believe.
In fact, the FCC repealed a rule, or a forthcoming rule, about ISPs being allowed to sell customer data earlier this year. So there's sort of separate piece of rulemaking for them.
All right, David in Brighton. Go ahead, David.
Hi. Hey, guys. How you doing? My question is how you guys define high-speed internet to be. I mean, a lot of companies like Spectrum and Frontier advertise that their internet connections are high-speed, even with, you know, baseline packages, whereas providers like Greenlight, I personally have Greenlight, their slowest speed is actually faster than a lot of the, quote, high-speed internet from the other providers. I'm wondering, how would you define high-speed internet, and whether or not those companies are potentially falsely advertising what they mean by high-speed?
I think from a consumer point of view, it's what makes you not annoyed. So I'm not to be silly about it, but it's sort of an issue of, you know, if you're waiting for something that isn't video, you shouldn't have to wait anymore. Even for web designers 20 years ago, it was a big issue deciding how will you entertain the user, like why everything slowly appears on the screen. And that's not anymore. So that shouldn't be happening. If video is breaking up, that's a problem. You know, if many people in your house are watching video at the same time and it stops working, that's a problem. I also think our expectations for what is high speed will keep going up. People think they want it to be more and more wonderful. And if it's not, that's not good. And, you know, slowly we're going to have more and more higher expectations.
Okay.
I would say also we use speed as a shorthand for a lot of different performance metrics online, right? Speed is not the only thing you care about. There are things called like jitter and latency. If you're watching a movie on Netflix, probably you care less about whether it takes a minute for it to start than if it's going to keep cutting out and pausing in the middle, right? So there are a lot of quality of service issues that we sort of subsume under this idea of speed that are equally, if not more important when you're talking about internet performance.
Anybody who doesn't know what a dot matrix printer sounds like, you know, you don't know what speed is until you're waiting, until you are a student who didn't wait until the night before, but you wait until the morning of to write your English paper in Mrs. Weatherby's junior year English class at Westlake High School, and your dot matrix printer is slowly going across the page. That's nervous time, and you don't have to deal with that anymore, or you shouldn't, is sort of the point that Jeremy is making when it comes to speed, how our perception of speed changes. Over the years, come to really appreciate analogies that help us see things. And I want to read something that will help us close the hour, because as we go forward and we talk about net neutrality, and again, we talk about, well, what does deregulating mean? And is that a good thing or a bad thing in the context of the future of the internet? Christian Dawson is the co-founder of the Internet Infrastructure Coalition, the I2 Coalition. He happens to be my cousin, but he's been on PBS NewsHour in a number of places talking about this. And here's what he wrote in a recent piece that helps frame it up for people like, I don't know, my family members. Here's what my cousin Christian wrote about this. He says, "My dad is in manufacturing. The things his company makes need to get shipped. I asked him to imagine a world in which he didn't have DHL, UPS, USPS, and FedEx to choose from, because they territorialized and each had their own region. Then I asked him to imagine a Wall Street Journal editorial that advocated giving those territorialized shippers the right to do whatever they wanted with shipping charges. Well, despite what the Wall Street Journal editorial board said, rolling back the open internet order is no more deregulating the internet than allowing postal delivery agencies to exploit the means of delivery would be deregulating manufacturing." And that's about the situation we have here. Is that a fair analogy?
Yes, I think the thing that it brings up that's most important here is that the internet is fundamentally a transportation technology. It moves packets from one place to another, and that a lot of the analogies that we use for thinking about it come back to that idea about how we move things across the country, across the world, and what the appropriate rules and restrictions should be for that.
Okay, and he goes on to say, what will the battle for the net hopefully achieve? He says, "A good start would be showcasing that the vast majority of the American public is in support of a ban on blocking, a ban on throttling, a ban on paid prioritization, and ongoing oversight of other discriminatory practices." Jeremy, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to all the arguments are related to either, you know, who is it going to help in terms of the ISP versus the different web companies? But there's no argument that says net neutrality should go away because it's going to help consumers. That doesn't seem to, you know, except for some sort of odd indirect way. And so in the end, depending on where the law goes, it's a question of if you're mostly there to help the people in terms of the politicians, you know, what kind of decisions are you making?
But what do you expect to happen this year, Jeremy? Wrap it up in a little bow for me. What should we expect?
I'd like to think that the net neutrality laws will not change, that this perhaps, and that the one reason that may not happen is that it's not sort of a sexy bit of legislation, as we talked about. You know, as John Oliver jokes, you know, it's kind of boring, even though Hope Weekly, we made it otherwise. And so I hope nothing happens.
Okay. What do you think is going to happen, Josephine?
I think the open internet order is going to be repealed. In my most optimistic predictions, I think the ISPs then decide this has become such a light rod issue that they still stay away from it and don't make major changes to their offerings.
That's the best case.
I think so.
Okay. Thanks to Josephine Wolf, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Computing Security at RIT. Always good to have you. Thank you. And Jeremy Sarakin is Chair of the Media and Communication Department of St. John Fisher College, who has put in lots of WXXI hours this week. We'll get you your own minted badge. Thank you for being here,
Thank
as
you.
Always. Let's get a short break and more Connections next.